The conference is now being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time.
Thank you very much. In addition to the actually, let's take roll again for the sake of the recording. Margie Mylan?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. Cheryl Langenor?
Yes.
Sebastian?
Yes.
Steve Vine?
Yep.
Mike Rodenbaum?
Yes.
Scott Hempel?
Yes.
Ken Stubbs?
Yes.
Paul Sahara?
Yes, I'm on the phone.
And Susan Rad.
Here.
Is there anyone else on the line that hasn't been identified?
This is Danny.
Pardon?
Chuck Kisselberg.
Chuck Kisselberg. Thank you, Chuck.
John Nevitt.
Thanks, John.
Matt Miller from Oak Monitor.
Thanks, Matt.
Ray Fassett.
Thank you, Ray.
Danny Younger.
Thank you, Danny.
Kirk Prick.
Thanks, Kirk. And for there are a few folks here participating in the room. If you could introduce yourself.
Tim Ruiz with GoDaddy.
Tim Ruiz with GoDaddy. William Silverstein. And Grace Young. And we also have a number of ICANN staff, including John Jeffrey, Dan Halloran, Nicole, Karen Lentz, Patrick Jones, and myself, Craig Schwartz. And with that, I'm going to turn over the start of the session to John Jeffrey.
Can everyone hear me on the phone?
If you can be closer to your mic, it will be better.
Yes.
So, just so you're aware, we have a configuration issue in the room where the phone is not picking up the microphone, so we're going to try to walk toward the speaker to make sure that everyone on the phone can hear us. So if at any point people on the phone are unable to hear someone in the room, let us know and we'll slightly adjust where the microphones are in the room so that we can make sure everybody's being heard. So thank you for coming this morning. As you know, this is the second of two consultations on the CRAI report on registrar vertical separation issues. In the last discussion, there were a number of different models that were discussed. We're hoping to just drive right into it this morning. I know that some of you were on both on the first call and are on the second call again. So we're going to just start out by opening the floor to comments, and then assuming that we have some additional time, we might go back over some of the models that were discussed both in the comments that have been submitted as well as in the first meeting. But we want to leave as much time as possible for the people that have come on the call to make comments to be able to do so. So with that in mind, we're going to take a list of speakers so that we can do it in an organized fashion. So in the room, Tim Ruiz has already indicated that he wanted to speak. And is there anyone else in the room that wanted to be in line to speak? Okay, so does anyone on the phone want to get in the queue?
Yeah, John, I just have a point of order before Tim goes, if that's okay.
Sure.
For those of you... Yes, Tim, this
we're going to ask you all to identify yourself before you start speaking.
I just want to point out for those listening on the phone or those on the phone on this call for the first time or those listening to the recording that that I think it's very economical and a good thing that we drive right into the discussion. For those who wish more of a preamble about the content of the CRA report, they can go to the recording of the first minutes and or the recording of the first meeting and there get an explanation of the purpose of the CRA report and the purpose of these meetings.
And the link to that is actually provided directly on the notice of this meeting on the front page of the website in the right-hand column.
But if anybody else on the call wants an explanation now, we can take a few minutes and give that.
It's Sebastian, if I may.
Sebastian, was that a question, or did you just want to be added to the queue?
I would like to know if I can speak.
You can. We'll add you to the queue. Tim Ruiz?
Was there anyone else that wanted to be added to the queue? We think we can hear somebody in the background. Also, if you're not speaking and you have some background noise, if you could be sure to mute your phone, that'll help the rest of us as well.
Good, Tim.
Sir, just be careful, William.
Aaron, we'll put you in the queue.
Thank you.
And has anyone else joined that would like to get added to the queue? Right now we have Tim Ruiz, Sebastian, and Eric Bruna-Williams. And someone new who just joined us in the room?
Eric Durker.
Thank you.
This is Margie. I'd like to be in the queue as well.
Okay, Margie. Mr. Ruiz?
Okay, thank you. Again, Tim Ruiz with GoDaddy. I have several comments. I'll make them all here in one film. But I'd like to start out talking a little bit about the proposals that have been submitted as far as registrar across ownership.
Excuse me, Kurt, on a point of order. I can't hear Tim at all. All I can hear is just a little background.
You won't be able to move that over any further. Is it possible you could come closer to this?
I think we're all going to need to huddle.
If you want to speak, just maybe take a chair or stand.
Yeah, why don't we do that?
I'll huddle closer to my phone, too, Kurt.
Yeah, we're making some adjustments right now, so just bear with us for one moment.
All right, so can you hear me now?
Yes. Thank you, Tim.
You're welcome, Ken, just for you. Again, let me start again. We have several comments. I'm not going to probably make them here all in one fell swoop, but as we talk about different aspects. But one area that I did want to have a response to, maybe some questions that could be answered by some who actually proposed these concepts, and that's the registrar registry cross ownership in regards to new registries being able to kind of get a foothold in the market by allowing them to have a specific limit or a specific number of registrations that they can register directly, or perhaps through an accredited registrar that they own or control. But then after that limit, then that ability ceases. The names can continue to be managed, but they're no longer able to register names. So a few comments about that, concerns that we have. One, I think we voiced before, and the registrar's constituency as a whole, for the most part, I believe, has had the same concern. And that is that by allowing registrars to actually do this directly on outside of the accredited registrar paradigm, then what we risk are certain registrar protections that are provided through both the registrar accreditation process as well as through consensus policy. So we're concerned about how those would be addressed under this new paradigm of registries being able to register domain names directly to end users. I mean, this wouldn't be, I'm assuming, not done within the limited way that it's been done with some of the sponsored GTLDs, but these could be open GTLDs or community GTLDs that have quite a much larger audience. So their potential market would be much larger, not within a real closed system. So that's one concern that we have. And it really doesn't seem to me or to us that it makes any sense to do it outside of the existing paradigm. That what it does is creates an additional mechanism by which ICANN needs to ensure that the protections that registrants have now through accredited registrars will still be provided. Another system of enforcement of some nature that's going to need to be applied in order to make sure registries are complying. Yet by having the registry use an accredited registrar that they manage, that they control, or that they own, is a much different. It falls within the existing paradigm. It provides for the registrant protections that already exist, and it will automatically come under any new consensus policy, and it doesn't require ICANN to come up with new ideas on enforcement or how to see whether or not registries actually are maintaining the requirements that are set upon them to do this. So that would be one thing, that we don't disagree with the concept, but that it should be done only through ICANN-accredited registrars. But the other problem we have with it is the limit on the number of names. And it really seems to us that all it really does is provide a sort of warm fuzzy to those who are concerned about it. That, you know, if there's going to be gaming going on, for example, within this type of arrangement, it's more than likely going to happen within the first 50 to 100,000 domain names, which are the two limits that we've heard bandied about. That's where most of the valuable names exist, is in that first 50 to 100,000. So gaming or other problems that could occur because of the value of a name or the quality of a name or how names are going to be allocated, those are going to be primarily or the biggest concern up front during the allocation of those first 50 to 100,000 domain names, and probably even much less. So if we had to accept a limit of something like that, it should be much smaller than 50,000 names. But we propose that there doesn't need to be one at all, that all we're really getting out of that is a warm fuzzy. The other problem with putting a limit in is at some point, registrations are going to cease. So now you have, you know, potentially 50 to 100,000 or at least tens of thousands of registrants who purchase domain names through a particular entity that they can no longer purchase domain names through. So the fact that they can still manage those names there is not going to be very comforting to those customers who now have to look for another source for domain names in that particular TLD. They want additional names, now they've got to look at, well, we've got to manage them with two different entities. Or they have to figure out how they're going to transfer those names from the existing entity to their new registrar. I'm not even sure how they'd understand why that is happening or why that's taking place. So we create this potential of some pretty big customer confusion. And I don't think that should be understated, given our own experience about things like this. When things are confusing to our customers, it can be a very large customer service expense. This is something that the registry can expect to have to deal with, given that they're the ones that actually registered these domain names. It certainly shouldn't be the responsibility of the new registrar, plus me, to have to support customers with those kinds of questions and problems. The other question that we have is that what evidence is there that this would be a problem? In fact, we feel just the opposite, that there's evidence that it wouldn't be a problem. I mean, we've already seen it happen in the marketplace. It already currently exists with Hostway and their ownership of .pro. It existed for a period of time with .com and .net, with VeriSign having both the registry and registrar functions under its control. I mean, even though that was eventually split out, to our knowledge, unless we're corrected here, we're not aware that was done because of any real problems that existed. It was done more based on fears of problems that might exist. And we're not aware of any issues that are arising with the Hostway.pro ownership either. And then when you look into the CCTLD space, you even see more of that going on. There's really very few restrictions of that regard on many of the CCTLDs that are sold in sort of a GTLD type of way. There's very little problems that we're aware of with that. In fact, we're involved with one of those registries, .me. GoDaddy is a major shareholder, so to speak, in that venture. We saw initial startup issues with some registrars having concerns, as I've mentioned before, over GoDaddy's involvement. All that really served to do was just check us to make sure that we weren't taking advantage, that we weren't in any way showing that we had some sort of advantage up on everybody else, special pricing, whatever it might be, because our concern was we wanted the CCTLD to be successful, and to do that, it had to have the entire or as much of the entire registrar community on board as possible. So today we have over 100 registrars signed up for for selling down heat. So I think there's some checks and balances that would naturally be in place just due to the desire for a GTLD to be successful in the market. So I guess I'll leave my comments there at this point and see if there's any response to that.
Kurt, I'd like to get in the queue. It's Paul Lehrer.
I'd like to get in the queue for a response, please.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first name. I did hear Ken Stutz.
Paul Stutz was the first one.
Okay, Paul.
I was talking to Paul, but that's all right.
So we'll take a queue now to respond to Tim's comments, but we're still keeping the original queue for the folks that expressed an interest to speak. So
I have Mike Roden, I have questions for Tim.
Okay. So in the queue for the response to Tim, we have Paul Stahura, Ken Stubbs, and Mike Roddenbauer. Would anybody else like to respond to Tim's comments?
Yes, William.
Thank you, Eric. Paul Stahura, the floor is yours.
Okay, so the first thing Tim said was about a registry selling directly without the registrar. I agree with Tim. I think... we could accomplish that by, you know, if the registry could own the registrar and that the registrar could sell the names, in which case the registry is not selling them directly to registrants. I agree with Tim. That's the structure we should use because it keeps the all the contracts intact, and it's not that much more of a cost for the registry to, you know, to incorporate another entity and get that thing accredited. So I agree with Tim. We shouldn't allow the registry to sell directly because we have another mechanism for them to be able to do that. Now, regarding the threshold, I see Tim expressed the benefit, which is the warm and fuzzy, he said. And, you know, there is something to be said for the warm and fuzzy, in my opinion. But I'm thinking that it could create more issues that it solves. You know, what happens when they hit the threshold and so on. But I do see the basically the benefit is if we're more assured if it's less than the threshold that there's not... what's the word I'm looking for? It's not unfair if it's a small number. So that's why I'm really fluctuating on the threshold thing, but I think I'm coming out more on Tim's side on that one. That's it.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Ken Stutz?
Yeah, thank you very much. Tim, I have a couple of responses. First of all, going back about 10 years ago to the concerns that were expressed by the original Network Solutions ownership of both the registry and the registrar, those concerns came primarily from the registrar community, expressing serious concerns about preferences, about the ability to maintain confidentiality, about equal access, not just technical, but to information. Also, in those days, we did not have the rampant warehousing of domain names. As a matter of fact, the original concerns that were expressed by ICANN to the original five registrars who were originally accredited was a strong desire not to have warehousing. And also, I think from a practical standpoint, over the last 8 to 10 years, many of the clauses that have been put in the existing registry agreements were done so to a great extent by lobbying efforts by registrars expressing serious concerns about the ability of the registry to have some sort of access to the registrants. As a matter of fact, I will remember that just after Affiliates had its sunrise we attempted to try to contact the registrants to determine how effective the Sunrise was for them, were they treated fairly, and so forth. And we basically had an uproar in the registrar community about the concerns, and one of the principal issues that was brought forth at that time was the registrar's strong desire to maintain the independence of the registrars from the registry. Now all of a sudden, what for the last 10 years has been a concern expressed by registrars is suddenly going to be all right. I just have trouble buying that, considering all of the issues that have surfaced with registrar problems over the last 3 to 5 years. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. Mike Roddenberry, you're next in the queue.
Thanks, Craig. So Tim, I think you, at the outset you're arguing that the registry direct model would somehow impact registrant protections that they have under the RAA. I'm just wondering if you could specify what sorts of things you're really worried about there, and I guess why that wouldn't be taken care of if the registry just agreed to be bound by the RAA.
Well, that's kind of what we're saying, right? That the that we want to see the registry in some way bound by the RAA, including the consensus policies that really become a part of it once they become an official consensus policy. And so there's in section 4, don't know exact parts here, I don't have it in front of me, but you know, there's a number of areas in which consensus policy can be enacted, and a lot of policies have been enacted, if that's the right term, in those different areas that registrars are bound to, as well as information about or requirements in regards to who is and making that publicly accessible and making sure the registrars are informed about how their information is used and et cetera, et cetera. So there's a number of requirements within the RAA as well as through consensus policy that follow it that we want to see the registry who is selling direct be bound to. What we're saying is that instead of creating this whole new sort of regime of registries that sell direct now, it's where we have another kind of agreement, another kind of enforcement, another kind of policy process. I'm not even sure how that would really work or apply. Why go through all of that? Why put ICANN through that and the community through that when we have a paradigm that exists that works, relatively speaking, I guess, in some people's minds, but it exists today. Nothing needs to be done, and that is simply through the existing registrar accreditation program. So instead of a registry in some way trying to become accredited itself, it's allowed to own or operate or control an accredited registrar. The other thing that provides, and I didn't really mention, is some protection against giving an impression to the registrants, to the disadvantage of other registrars who might want to participate, that somehow going direct to the registry has some advantage. I mean, you wouldn't even have to say it. Just the fact that you're going direct to the registry to register name certainly implies that there's some sort of advantage, and I think that disadvantages other registrars then who want to participate. But if there's some separation of a legal nature with this other entity that the registry may control, then that isn't as a stark of a problem. In fact, most of our registry, the agreements registrars have with registries, require us not to in any way indicate that we somehow provide some advantage over other registrars in relationship to our association with the registry or our connections to it, et cetera. We're not allowed to do that. So neither would this new accredited registrar, is what I would assume. So there's a lot of existing protections for registrants and for equitable treatment for registrars that exist with the paradigm we have today without having to start something new.
Curtis, Paul, can I have another shot at the apple?
Yeah, you can right after Eric Runner Williams.
And this is Kurt. I'd like to get in the queue too.
Yeah, Eric.
Thank you much, Kurt. Craig. Responding to Tim's 3 points, and I won't respond to the third point because Ken Stubbs already addressed that, that ME is not equal to COM. But going to the first point that you made, Tim, I agree in distinguishing between sponsors and what I'll call narrow community for the purposes of this call, and what you suggested was a broader communities that have very broad definitions, that if we're dealing with a threshold for some purpose, and presumably it's to make the registry its first year of operation, distinguishing between sponsored and narrow community versus broader community or games community is an important point to make. There, in your response to Mike Rodenbach, you talked about registrar protection. And I want to point out that where there's a pre-existing nexus between the applicant and the community, which is the case for the community applications, at least the ones that are not games community applications, but we don't have any examples of it at the moment. But let's take CAT as an example of a community application, or co-op as an example of a sponsored application, where there is a pre-existing nexus between the registry applicant and the registrant community. That's a different thing than the general new startup GTLD, where the registry advantage that you pointed out in your rebuttal is a reasonable concern. So I wanted to agree with you in part and disagree with you in part on your first point about thresholds, that narrow community and sponsor is different from broad community of games, and that registrant protection is appropriate when we're talking about an application for which there's no community nexus between the community and the applicant. Going to your second point about the warm and fuzzy, I completely agree. And the 50K to 100K limit is way too high when we think about gaming. But I wanted to point out that there were no good names for CAT, and there are no good names for co-op, although chicken is a good name for co-op, but for chicken feed. So good names actually don't exist for some class of registries where the pre-registration verification process is strong. And since I haven't heard any audio feedback, I have no idea if I'm talking to a void or not. But I'll stop there. Thank you.
We hear you, Eric.
No,
okay.
Came through loud and clear.
Paul Staher, you are next in the queue to respond to Tim's comments.
Yeah, I was really going to play off of Ken Stubbs' comments. He brought up warehousing. I just wanted to point out that, yeah, warehousing was talked a lot about in the past, but it was never made a consensus policy to prohibit it. So I don't see how that plays too much into this discussion, especially when we had, you know, .asia and .mobi go live. Were those registries allowed to retain certain names and auction them off to the highest bidder? So it's almost the opposite of warehousing. I mean, it's nearly been sanctioned to allow these registries to sell names to the highest bidder. Number two is, I think the situation we have now is different from in the past, because now we have, in the past, the registries were price limited. And this time around, it seems, though, that the registries will not be price limited, so that's a big difference in my mind this time versus last time, so it's not the same. And one more thing about Eric's comments regarding community, my feeling is the structure that we have, the legal separation of registrars and registries still works, even with a community. That community registry could have an ICANN-accredited registrar, which could perform the community checks, like, you know, determining whether the registrant is a member of the community and checking their credentials and so on. So I think the legal separation registry and registrar still works in that situation.
Thanks, Paul. Kurt, you are next in the queue. Kurt Britt?
Yep, I'm here. Thanks. Tim, I'd just like to repeat back to you the model you're proposing so I make sure I understand it, but it is that ICANN accredited registrars should still exist, but GTLD registry and registrar can be co-owned by the same entity, and that registrar could sell names in that registry, and that the limit on those names be unlimited. Is that correct?
That's correct. With one, I just want to make sure you didn't imply something that I didn't mean to.
But I didn't imply something I didn't mean to. I'm not implying that they would have to be restricted to just that GTLD. If it's an accredited registrar, why not allow them to register names in other GTLDs? Some of the things we've heard raved about that, access to registrant information, and another one was the check information. Well, in reality, they have all that today. The contact information is public information. Registrars are required, whether many of us do or not, but we're required to make it available in a bulk manner. We have access via port 43. We have access via web interface. So all this data is public today. It's not anything new. And in fact, there's really nothing restricting registrars from taking their customer file and making it available for marketing for other purposes. So all those things and those concerns exist today. And the same with the availability checks. You know, when someone comes to GoDaddy, and I know it's true with numerous other registrars, and they type in a domain name and they check its availability, we don't, and just because they selected .com from the drop-down doesn't mean that we only send that information to .com. We send it to Afilias, we send it to Neustar, we send it to, I can't tell you how many other CCTLD registries. So they all have that information because we send it to them at that same moment in time. And that's true with numerous other registrars. So I don't understand where that would really change anything if this new entity, this registrar co-owned by the same entity as the registry, one would have access to information they don't have access to today.
One of the, this is Kurt, one of the assertions in the CRA report was that it would be difficult to enforce contractual provisions that guarantee an even playing field for all registrars if one of the registrars was owned by a registry, that registrar could get preferential treatment in a way that couldn't be prevented. Can you help refute that or discuss that?
Well, I would just like to understand how that can happen. I mean, we have those requirements today. If some registry and registrar, Afilias and GoDaddy, I mean, we've partnered on a couple different things that are pretty public knowledge. What is ICANN's mechanism today for enforcing that? Why is it only a concern if they're owned by the same entity? I can see where that might be raise more concern, but I don't think it really changes anything, and I don't really understand how that legal connection could really pose more dangers than what really exists today. And
I'd like to that too, Kurt. It's Paul.
Can I respond to Kurt's thing as well, Ken Stubbs?
So I guess the bottom line is that it's either enforceable or it isn't. I don't see where that relationship changes that.
Kurt, did you want to follow up, or should we hear from Paul?
I was thinking of different transfer pricing or different economies that can be realized between co-owned entities, but I'd rather hear from the others.
Paul Stahura.
I agree again with Tim. That could happen now, even though a registry doesn't own a registrar. It could have a special deal, but on the side, and it would be hard to detect. Yet, that registry would be violating their registrar, their ICANN agreement by, giving unequal treatment to one registrar, even if they didn't own it, which is a big risk for the registry if it does become detected, and B, there maybe should be provisions, audit provisions and so on, which I think are proposed in those agreements, so that the ICANN could maybe from time to time check on these registries to make sure that they are performing, giving access to the registry equally or equitably or whatever the language is. The other point is, if they weren't, likely that other registrars would figure that out. In the .com case, for example, in the drop, let's say, one registrar, it's public information, which registrar gets which names. If one registrar is getting its unfair share of names in the drop, all the other registrars would know that. It could, those could inform ICANN and say, look, there's some kind of shenanigans going on, and check up on the registry, especially if the registrar that's getting its unfair share of names is owned by the registry. So, you know, even though it's difficult to detect it, it's not impossible to detect it, and it's in the other registrar's interest to monitor it and to inform ICANN if they suspect some unequal treatment. So, in conclusion, Tim is much more articulate than I am, but I agree with what he said.
Did somebody call my name?
Yeah, go ahead, Ken.
Yeah. You asked for examples, Kurt. I'll give you a perfect example because this actually was a serious concern in the original network solutions requirements. Let's assume Registrar X owns the registry for .fud. And let's assume that the price for domains is $10. Registrar X has a minimal entity cost between the two entities for those registrations, significantly less than any of the other registrars. So Registrar X starts marketing .fud and throwing in all sorts of accessorizing options that other registrars cannot afford to do and be competitive, or Registrar X elects to market .fud at a significantly lower price than the other registrars because the net cost, there's no real economic penalty to the unit in a case like that. And if Registrar X does a reasonably good job of servicing those accounts, he is going to have a very high retention rate. There will not be any real incentive to transfer away to other registrars. So it would allow Registrar X out of the box a significant advantage. And now some people might argue that the other registrars would be upset with this and would stop marketing .fud. That isn't necessarily the case. There is enough of a demand for names out there that other registrars may very well have to continue this, but there's a significant disservice to the registrar community in a situation like that, and creates a lot of contentiousness, and it frankly is not good for the process. Thank you.
This is Richard Tindall. Can I get in the queue, please?
Go ahead, Richard, you're up.
I'd like to be in the queue also.
Richard, you wanted to respond to
that? Yeah, I am. I wanted to respond to Ken's comment,
okay.
And I understand what he's saying. I just feel that the whole premise of that approach is that the competing registrars are something that the registry wants to do away with and get rid of if it can, that they're not adding any value to the process, and that the registry is going to do everything it can to harm the other registrars and benefit its own. Again, I think in an unprice-capped registry situation, the registry is incented to have the other registrars add value to distribution, and I don't know why the registry would do things to harm its other distribution channels. If they're adding value to the registry is going to want to treat them well. That's what tends to happen in other industries. I don't know why it would happen differently in this one in an unprice-capped situation.
Okay, we're going to... Thanks for your comment, Paul. We're going to take Tim Ruiz is going to make a comment, and then Bill Silverstein is going to make a comment, and then we'll move back to the original queue.
This is Kurt. I had one more question for Tim too. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, just wanted to respond to Ken briefly, and you know, and I've heard that concern too, Ken, and I guess being in this situation we're in with .me is kind of been an eye-opener in a lot of ways. And I think basically what Richard just said is kind of where I was going, that I don't think the impact of your reputation on the rest of the registrar community, the rest of the industry, can really be understated. It really is significant. No registrar or no entity wants to own a registry and a registrar and have and have one or the other be more successful. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, if you want the registry to be successful, then you need industry-wide support. If you want a registrar to be successful, then it can't be taking advantage of competitors, because then that turns around and has an impact on the registry. So just from our perspective and the checks that it's kind of put on us, when we think about all of this, I really think that to some extent those fears are kind of overstated. And again, we do have some examples to look at within the CCTLD community. Not that I really believe that necessarily mirrors what could happen in the GTLD space, but I think that it's something to look at, that those situations exist, and we don't see that kind of thing happening with any alarm that I'm aware of.
Thanks, Tim. We'll take Bill Silverstein and then Kurt Price.
Regarding the unequal pricing on a registry to someone related to them versus someone not related, I don't think there'd be a lower price issue, because that would be a little bit too obvious for somebody to see, as opposed to adding more bells and whistles with their basic pricing. But there's also the issue I can see, which is enforcement by the other registrars themselves, or by the public at large, because from what I can see, the only way to do that is to enforce it via ICANN, as opposed to enforcing it directly via some sort of lawsuit. Because the other registrars or the public, I don't believe, are listed as third-party beneficiaries of these contracts. And I'm not an attorney, but I think that they may not have standing to do it directly.
Kurt, I have a comment on the pricing, since it's come up. Paul.
Okay, Paul, why don't you make your comment on pricing, and then we'll go to Kurt.
There is, if a registrar owns a registry, or let's in the .com case, let's say the registry performs, offers registrations direct to the public, but via another registrar, so they would be acting as a seller of another registrar. In either of those cases, there is no economic incentive for the registry to lower their prices to themselves or to the public, because they could sell the name for $7. Why sell it for $6? So, if in the .com case, because it's an extreme case, let's use that one. Why would VeriSign, even if they owned a registrar, offer names for less to the public than what they can get for offering them to TwoCows or Enum or GoDaddy or anybody else? That's why that whole price argument it doesn't make sense to me. There's no economic incentive for them to lower prices to themselves.
Actually, I do have a response to that, and it's one word. It's called upsells. Because it may not have been like that 10 years ago, but now when you register a domain with a registrar such as GoDaddy, they will offer you web hosting service, email service, optimization service, and I've lost track of how many other services that they offer once they get you in the door to buy that domain. They will, I believe they still offer this, which is they will let you register a domain name for $1.99 if you buy some other services from them.
Correct. So therefore, GoDaddy is, let's say GoDaddy is already doing that. Why would the registrar, and they're paying the registry $6 or $7, whatever the current price is. Why would the registry do that when they're getting $7 from GoDaddy? Why would they do it for $1?
Because they would be, is that it would allow GoDaddy, if a registry was giving GoDaddy a preferential price, they would be able to offer a few more bells and whistles or a lower price to some customer off the street, so to say, to get them into the door. And then, of course, typically once...
I hear you, but that customer off the street is getting into the door because they're going to GoDaddy.
Right, but they're going to GoDaddy because GoDaddy is offering, with this domain at this price, you get A, B, and C free, and then once they get them in the door with the A, B, and C free, they sell them D, E, and F.
I hear you, but the registry makes more money selling them to GoDaddy, since GoDaddy's offering them for $1. They're selling more names, but getting paid $7 from the registry point of view. So why would the registry offer them for $1? That's
because
my point.
Because they're related, so the people who own the registry also have a beneficial interest in the registrar, so they're making more money that way by getting more people to go through everyone they own and buy more from GoDaddy versus buying more from, let's say, Monica, who doesn't have this special relationship.
The registry can do that now without these contracts. The registry could become a reseller of two cows, pay him a penny over $7, $7.01, and then their reseller could bundle all this stuff with it, as you say, A, B, C, D, and E, F, sell the meanings for $1, and everything would happen as you just said. But since they're not doing that, in my opinion, that shows that it's not in their economic incentive to do it. I wouldn't do it if I was them either.
I just want to say, too, that you know,
they can do that
this,
without
back,
owning a registrar.
On our experience with Not Me, you know, typically in any TLDs that we offer, and not all of them, but the majority that we offer, GoDaddy is, we estimate, 30 to 50% of the market in that GTLD. The same, I'm sure, is true in .me, although I couldn't tell you right off the top of my head exactly what that percentage is, but I know it's significant. But you know what? Let's say it's 40%. The other 60% of the market, even as speaking from a registry perspective, we sure don't want to kiss that off. That's important. So why would GoDaddy take actions that could potentially see 60% of its market disappear into thin air? I don't think it's going to happen, and I think that's going to be similarly true with any GTLD that's trying to get its foot off the ground. They want the whole market. They want to be successful, and they can't live off of what even if it's a significant chunk, it's not the whole chunk that their own owned registrar is actually going to garner.
So we'll have Kirk Pritz with the final word in this subject, and then we'll move on to the original queue. Kurt?
Yeah, sorry, did you say Eric or
Kurt?
No, I said Kurt.
Yeah, so this isn't the final word, but I just wanted to get a further understanding from Tim Ruiz. In a model where a registrar cannot sell names for that registry except for, you know, a co-owned registry where the registrar can only sell, say, 100,000 names, and then be stopped. You said that would lead to gamesmanship, and I'd be interested in understanding what some of those games are. Not because I'm with you. I agree with you. It probably is, but I'd like that, you know, fleshed out a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I think if gaming is going to occur, it's going to occur either way. I mean, if a registry has propensity to try to game by somehow taking advantage of those more valuable names in the beginning or how they're allocated or whatever, I think that's going to happen regardless of whether there's a cap or not. What I'm saying, there may be a bigger propensity for that to happen if there is a cap, because now they know they have a limited time or a limited number of names to within which to game. But what I'm saying is that that putting a cap on it isn't going to prevent it. That it's within that first 100,000 or 50,000 names where that kind of gaming is going to be more likely to occur. It's where it really matters. It's where, you know, the most valuable names are allocated in some form or another. So it's after that when that type of thing, or warehousing, or whatever the concerns might be, really diminish. And so I don't see why what the point of the cap is. I think it just basically allows them, you know, an open window to do the gaming that everyone's concerned about. Within the prime part of the distribution of those names, or during that time.
I see what you're saying.
If I may, finally, this is Eric.
Are you still responding to Tim, Eric?
Yes. This is actually a response to Paul's comment about that legal preparation work, even for community. I concur. None of our applications are predicated on any changes in the rules whatsoever. And finally, to
I think the gaming will be a problem well under the 50,000 cap. So we have to look to even the first 100 games to figure out. And people would like to understand the, where the gaming occurs or how it occurs in the exercise of doing the first 100. But again, this isn't a problem for pre-validation.
Eric, hold on 1 second, please. You have a question.
We're having a little bit of trouble hearing you. Could you try to speak a little bit slower and more clearly?
Yeah, I'll try swallowing the mic and speaking slower.
Thank you.
The problem that of the exhaustion or the value of the initial inventory of 50,000 or 100,000 names is not present where there is a strong validation policy. So for those applications which propose pre-validation like CAP did, or Catalan content as CAP did, or co-op or museum, those models, this problem is not present. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks, Tim Ruiz. So we'll move back to the original queue, and that, Sebastian, are you still with us?
I try to keep here. I am the impression that I am on a wrong call. No introduction. We were supposed to have read the document in English prior and to listen to the previous conference call. And the announcement of those was just a few days ago. And I think it's really a capture of the discussion by the one who knows. And that's great, but I think that as an end user representative here, I couldn't put any voice because you are not giving me help to understand the question and where we are. It seems to me that some historical background and Ken Stubb get some of them could be very important because I think when the split was done between registry and registrar, there was some important reason to do that. And the negotiation between ICANN and Verisign at that time was in exchange of something else. And I think if we don't put all those history and background to us before any discussion, it's a little bit difficult. And my last point, it seems that on the web page where there is a summary of what we are supposed to discuss, I have the impression that there are an error, and even if it's registry and registrar in English, it's very close. It seems that the phrase where it's written, second, Cray proposed to a registry may own a registrar so long as the wholly owned registrar does not sell second-level domain name subscription in the TLD operated by the registrar. I think there is something wrong in this sentence. It may be a registry at the end of the sentence. At least it was my impression in English, and as you know, I am not a primary English speaker. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sebastian. We'll have to look into that to check on the wording of the document. Eric Bruner-Williams, you're next in the queue.
So thank you. I'll unmute and see if that works. Can you hear me?
You can.
Okay. I'm going to not read the comment I just sent in earlier today, which is two comments on the NSI proposal from the first consultancy. But I'm responding to two of the points which I think we've been turning around and around. The first one is that there's some kind of benefit obtained from cross-ownership. And I just can't see where that actually arises. I don't propose to read to you all. You can all read it yourselves unless you want me to. And then there's the second assertion that was made. This is responding to John Nevitt's proposal, which was made somewhat informally during the last consultation in D.C., and then in writing to the for the consultation and in that. The second assertion is that the self-ownership somehow is the appropriate mechanism to attain a policy goal, which she suggests is to make registries competitive. And I thought hard about that one too, and I just don't see that is the only mechanism that's available to us, or in fact that it's a mechanism that has ever worked. The only one that's really worked in the past 10 years of our industry has been the redelegation of .org, which was taking the existing inventory, independent of the registrar, moving the existing inventory from the monopoly incumbent operators to the new competitive registry operators. So when we think about new community applications, and let's take co-op because it's something that we all have had 10 years of observation, there are more cooperatives registered in .com or a .net than there are in .com. That's an inventory that has been stranded by fine. They were registrations made either prior to the competitive regime coming into existence in 1999, the competitive registrar regime, that is, or they're registrations which are driven by the effective mind share that the .com brand has. And we're not really solving the problem if we try to create a competitive cooperative registry and put cooperative again, substitute any community that you care to, or in fact any new proposition that you care to. If we leave that, those many registrations, many times the existing volume is not co-op, stranded in the verifying registry in the incumbent monopoly. So the choice that we had in 1999 was, there were two choices. One was to not change the namespaces, but create competition within the namespaces through the registry backend. The other choice was to create this apparent competition through registrars, which hasn't led to any real increase in competition in the total registry market. So those are the two points that I made in the note that I sent to the list earlier today, and I'll stop there.
Thanks, Eric. Margie, you are next in the queue.
This is Richard Tindall. I've got a comment on Eric when I'm in the slot.
Okay, why don't we take your comment on Eric's remarks, and then we'll move on to Margie.
Yeah, so I just wanted to add to what Eric said. I think one of the reasons that Com is dominant today is that there was that period of time when Com launched, when Network Solutions was able to act as a retail promoter of its own brand. It's not the only reason, but I think it's an important reason why Com became so powerful. And I think to prohibit new TLDs from having that same advantage of being able to get their own brand out to the market, I think that would be hobbling the competitivity of the new TLDs.
If I may respond to Richard.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, Richard, we're addressing two separate points. I'm suggesting that the existing stranded inventory is what we should be talking about moving to make the new registry, the new competitive registry, in fact, viable and therefore eventually competitive. That's different from assuming that having the registry registrar self-ownership as the mechanism, that that's actually going to be successful. That's all I wanted to say.
If there's no further follow-up to Eric's remarks, Margie, you're next in the queue.
I just wanted to make some disclosure. My comments are on Mark Bonner's behalf. I think many of you have heard that I'll be joining ICANN in January, so these are clearly not ICANN comments. And so I had two points I wanted to raise. The first one, I think it's some of the issues we've already discussed. I agree, or Mark Monitor agrees with the concerns about additional safeguards needed if there wasn't a separation between a registrar and a registry. Mark Monitor doesn't care whether those relationships stay in place, but that just wants to clarify that there are issues related to pricing, related to product tie-ins, that sort of thing, to answer some of the concerns that were raised by Paul and Tim. when you talk about why would a registry, you know, drop its price, one of the things that we could see is if the registry is making significant revenue from other services that really aren't domain related. You can think of the example of like certificates or, you know, something like that. That's where the price discussions may, you know, analysis may change because there might be more, significantly more dollars associated with these other names, other types of services as opposed to the registration. So that's just a, all we wanted to point out was that, you know, there needs to be additional attention if ICANN were to allow registries to, you know, own registrars or vice versa. And so that, you know, and in the context of history, we've operated under both scenarios where when VeriSign, you know, owned NSI, as a corporate registrar, we were competing with VeriSign at that point. When VeriSign sold off its registrar business, we were still competing with VeriSign in the corporate space, and really the issues are the same because there's still the reseller relationship in either way. In either case, there is the registry can, you know, offer the services through a registrar, and I think, you know, in the end, it was roughly the same situation from a competitive standpoint.
Thanks, Marty.
I got it. It's Paul.
Go ahead, Paul.
You had me until like the, I was understanding it until the last part when you said it was the same in either way. I agree with that last part, that it is the same. That's why, since VeriSign, let's say, can offer names to the public and bundle them with certificates or whatever else they want to bundle them with, even though they don't own a registrar, because they could do that through another registrar and as a reseller of another registrar, and then they could lower their prices on those names in the bundled scenario to free. And since they can do that now and they're not, that's evidence to me that my theory is correct, which is it's not in their best economic interest to do so. So I see it is the same whether they own a registrar or sell names to the public through, as a reseller of another registrar. It's the same thing, and since they're not doing it, to me, it would make sense then for them to be able to own a registrar.
Yeah, and I think where we disagree is that it's not. That's just one example. That doesn't mean that every registry would take that position. You know, VeriSign, you know, tried to distinguish between their two businesses and did a fair job of, you know, separating those business units. That may not happen with other registries. And so my point is, you know, regardless of whichever way you go, whether you allow it or you don't allow it, I think you need to think about how the same issues arise in a reseller relationship.
Tim Ruiz, you wanted to make a comment?
Tim with GoDaddy again. Just along those same lines, I mean, I think from our perspective, you know, there really is not true competition within the registry space yet. You know, the dominance of .com is still pretty clear. We made some comments to that effect in what we submitted to ICANN in this, about the RFP. However, in order for that to change, it can't just be more TLDs in the G space. That's not going to change anything. What's going to make that change is when we can actually get mindshare away that's been captured by .com and start turning that around to be thinking about these other options. And that's what's not not happening. That's very difficult to make happen, and it's very difficult for even the existing registries to make that happen, who are relying primarily on the customer-facing registrars to do their marketing and their promotion. And they can't really force anything. They can make suggestions, they can offer programs, but they're still reliant very much on the customer-facing registrars to really promote their product and almost to do their branding for them, so to speak. But this other opportunity to for a registry or for a single entity to control both a registry and a registrar, it also then provides that opportunity for other marketing ideas, for other promotional types of concepts to actually get out there and maybe some true, real, successful attempt at starting to grab mindshare away from .com can be made, and we could actually see some competition in the GTLD space.
I have a comment on that, Paul.
Go ahead, Paul.
I agree with his first part, that we don't yet truly have competition at the registry level. No offense to the other registries, Info and Biz and so on. It's not easy. I agree with him when he says part of it is getting the branding and the marketing message of the registry out there. It's hard when there's one giant gorilla called Com. But I disagree with him when he said that. Here's where I disagree. I believe that if we had a number of GTLDs, like whatever, 40, larger number even, out there, that just the fact that these other GTLDs are out there and there's a large number of them would help to change the perception of people using the internet that there are these other good GTLDs that exist. And so I think that that would help bring competition because of the number of new TLDs that would be introduced. So I'm an advocate for having a larger number of GTLDs introduced, not a smaller number.
I think it's just the opposite, but I don't know if this is the forum for that discussion or not.
Thanks, Paul.
So I had a couple other points. Can I go on?
Sure, go ahead, Margie.
Okay. If there is a situation where a registry owns a registrar, one of the things that we think would be important is to require physical separation. I think that's a key, in particular personnel, because I think that what would be a problem would be that the same people that operate the registry are also selling those services, to consumers customers, because that starts to reach a gray area as to whether or not other registrars have the ability to compete or not. And so as long as there's this continued notion of physical separation, if that were to happen, where you would allow the cross ownership, I think that would be the ideal situation. And then with regard to the corporate issue, this is kind of a separate issue on the Cray report. We agree at Mark Monitor that the corporate branding TLD situation is a little bit different than the other TLDs that we're talking about. And most of the discussion today relates to really the retail market for large registries and open registries. In the case of a corporate owned TLD that's used primarily for marketing purposes, where there's only one registrant or the registrant consists of affiliated entities, we just wanted to make it clear that is a separate situation, and that it'd be interesting to see how the ICANN rules would apply to that situation. For example, in talking to our customers, they some of them want registrars, some of them don't want registrars. Some of them want to work with only one registrar. It's all over the map from the corporate perspective. And so I just wanted to, at least since there may not be other corporate registrars on this call, identify the fact that yes, that is a separate case study, and Mark Monitor agrees that it probably requires more analysis because it's just a totally different scenario that ICANN's used to dealing with, given our the history and under the existing registries.
Thanks, Margie. Is there any feedback to Margie's comments? Are there other folks that would like to get in the queue to continue the dialogue?
Thank you, Eric.
Okay, Eric, actually you're up, and then we'll have Tim Ruiz.
Okay, in a sense, I'm really following Mr. Margie, who made the point that...
Eric, it's difficult to hear you again.
Right. There's someone doing a leaf blower near me, too, just to ask for this thing.
Do you want to wait till they pass and we'll come back to you?
I don't think I will. So the I agree with Margie that the culprit is a distinct use case from what we.
I'm really having.
Yeah, we're not getting anything you're saying, Eric.
Okay.
Why don't we go on to Tim and then come back to you in a moment.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a few comments about the single entity TLD as well. We'll have more comments on that when we actually submit them by the 23rd. But you know, we're concerned about that too. It isn't, and obviously this wasn't something that was in the original RFP. It's in the CRE report, and ICANN hasn't taken any positions. We understand, but we just would like to request that you proceed with caution on that, because there's a lot of unknowns there, a lot of questions that need to be answered. For example, you know, one of the examples on one of the calls we heard was a major portal that has a huge number of memberships, both from business people who are providing services and business people who are buying those services as well as users. And, you know, so what would a single entity TLD be? And where would the line be drawn as far as who could actually, they could actually give those domain names to, and what the size of that market is? I mean, how big can the market be before we're talking about a gTLD? I mean, isn't there some practical limit? So if you're talking about an entity that has, you know, tens of thousands and maybe hundreds of thousands, or in some cases, some of the examples I've heard, we're talking about millions, tens of millions of users, you know, where do we draw a line? So we just want to be careful that there isn't some slippery slope created with this single entity thing that's thought out very cautiously. And we would propose that this first round of gTLDs is too early to consider something like that, given it's a brand new idea as far as we're aware of, a lot of questions still exist and needs to be defined. So I would agree on that aspect of it with Margie.
I have a comment about the single entity CRE report thing.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead, Paul, and then we'll come back to Eric. Ahead, Paul.
I agree with him. I think that we shouldn't have to introduce kind of mechanism or schemes for these single entity TLDs. And I think that they can fit in the current you know, registrar structure. Single entity TLD owner applicant could also become a registrar and get accredited and offer the names to their employees or their whatever, their single entity, through that registrar. We still maintain all the current ICANN agreements and so on. If there is some restriction that they want to impose on their registry, like these names are only for our employees, then that registrar would be the only registrar that could authenticate those employees, because that registrar would be the only one who knew which registrants are employees and which potential registrants and which potential registrants aren't employees. So it can still work with the construct we have set up. I think that this round is for introducing gTLDs that should priority bring an additional competition to the registry space. And let's not overload it with single entity TLDs.
Thanks, Paul. Eric, did you want to jump back on now?
Well, I'll try, but I think it's sufficient to say I agree with Paul 100%. Did you hear that?
We did. Thank you.
Okay.
Is there anyone else on the call that would like to get in the queue, or participants that are here in the room? Hearing none, I'd like to remind folks that the public comment period on the CRA report is open through December 23rd, and that the MP3 recording of this consultation will be posted to the public comment form set up on the CRA report probably later this afternoon. Did you want to...
Greg, it's Mike Rodenmeyer. I have a question, a process.
Okay, Mike, go ahead.
I'm basically just wondering, what is the process? What is ICANN intending to do after these consultations and in response to this report?
This is Kurt. The answer to that is that we're going to take the input from these reports and synthesize it into the models that the people attending have proposed, and contrast that to the recommendations of the CRA report. So we have the next couple rounds of consultation, besides having more notice, will also be a more pointed discussion about the feasibility of different models. We expect that to happen, you know, in the first month or two of next year.
Okay, so is it expected that this is going to impact the new TLD draft applicant guidebook in the next iteration, or in the the next iteration after that?
I think that's yet to be determined. We're going to have to look at the consultations, the comments that have come in after the deadline ends, and then consider that.
Okay. I mean, I guess I'd just say there's quite a bit of confusion, at least in our constituency, as to what the purpose of this report was, what kind of process we're being asked to comment on here. Not real clear.
So it's meant to...
This is part of the broader consultation, both about the applicant guidebook, the implementation of the new GTLD policy process, and the general issue that's addressed in the paper. And we expect that there are going to be additional economic information studies that will be presented as we go through this process, and that depending upon those consultations, those studies, that overall look, that may affect the applicant guidebook before the end of the process.
This is John. I have a question. John Evett.
Okay, actually, let me take a cue now because a couple of people have lined up. So we've got John Evett, we've got Bill Silverstein.
Kurt?
Cheryl, unless Danny Young is still on the call, he's posted a question. I'll pass it on if needs be.
Okay, Cheryl, thank you. And there's a very heavy breather right next to the phone, so if you're not speaking, if you can mute, that would be great.
Hey, it's not me.
I don't know about that. John Evett, go ahead.
Thanks, Greg. Just a couple of points. The first one, to your point, John, that you just raised in answer to Mike's question, I would strongly encourage ICANN to any changes in the draft agreement or the draft RFP that come out of this CRA report, as I understand the timeline's got to be in this next round. There are definitely folks going out with business plans and planning for the new round of TLDs and not knowing whether a registry could be a registrar and a registrar be a registry, vice versa, or if there are any thresholds or anything like that is difficult for especially smaller entities that are looking at the possibility of applying for a new TLD. So I would encourage ICANN again to make a decision or put the draft out in the next round and not wait to the, as I understand, the final round when it's actually issued. And then the question I have for I guess John or Kurt, what impact will yesterday's letter from the Department of Commerce have on the analysis and additional economic studies or economic analysis might there be?
So, for those that don't know, there was a letter that was received as part of the comment process yesterday from the U.S. Department of Commerce, which contained an attached letter from the U.S. Department of Justice to them. That letter has just been received by us and is going to be considered as part of the overall comment. We don't have a statement or a comment about that at this time. And as for your first note, John, thank you for the comment about the timing. We appreciate the difficulty of the process that's going on, and the importance of including information like that as early as possible.
Thanks, John.
Bill Silverstein.
Well, I was thinking the heavy breathing was a comment on the XXX domain again. But what Paul said about the single entity, it does work except for financial, where you have, you will have, if you have multiple registrars trying to service the single entity, there's no profit motive for the registrars to go through all that work to do it when it is only a single entity. But as a general comment, I'd like everyone to keep in mind that the registrar and the registry are both essentially a fiduciary role to the public and to all the registrants. And they have to at least keep some appearance of credibility and at least be above reproach, or at least in theory. Because when you start doing things like domain name front running, or when domain names expire, you have a secret company holding them for you so you can then auction them off and see if they're worth auctioning before actually releasing them so other people can register them. That undermines the whole ICANN domain name system credibility.
Thanks, Bill. Kurt, you are next in the queue.
I didn't think I was.
Would you like to be?
No.
Okay. Eric.
Thank you. John, I hope you can hear me.
We can.
Yes, we can.
Good. I have the impression that you're treating the PRAI report as something which can become part of the guidebook, though it's never been a policy choice that has been put before the GNSO Council or the ICANN board. Am I correct in that understanding?
Can I object as a leading question? No, really, truly, I don't believe that that's true, but I'm not sure I understand exactly how to answer your question, because I think it's very pointed at a specific answer. I think that we believe that as part of Oh, I'm sorry. Did I interrupt your question?
I thought that you were... Well, I think we've interrupted each other.
Well, then please go ahead and restate your question, and I'll wait until you're completely finished before we answer.
Well, thank you, John. I'm concerned that a policy choice is being made without it being voted upon. I had correspondence with John about the registrar constituency's position on elements of the CRAI report in the past 2 days, and it was his impression that this would not come before the GNSO Council.
And you're referring to John Nevitt, correct?
I beg your pardon?
You're referring to John Nevitt, correct?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Is that enough information for you to try and answer to?
Okay, so if I understood, I'm sorry, can anybody restate the question, because I'm not sure I understand the pending question.
Well, I can try.
Go ahead. Tim Ruiz was coming to the microphone as well.
Oh, well, go ahead, Tim.
I'm coming.
I'll just give my perspective of where I think you're going, and then maybe that will either help or it won't help. But the way I view this is that this is the ICANN community's opportunity. ICANN hasn't made any decision. It issued a request for an economic study. Part of that's been done in regards to the registrar ownership aspect. That's been put out as is for public comment. Consultations have been called. So there's a lot of opportunity here for the community to express its views. I guess I don't see this as something that's a policy issue for the GNSO Council. I kind of fail to see where that would come under any of either the picket fence for the registries or the registrars. But I strongly agree that this would certainly be something that the community needs to have, to be fully vetted with the community, and they have an opportunity to fully respond to. But then once that's done, based on that comment, I would assume some decision down the road will be made, ultimately approved by the board.
Yeah, and just for some additional clarification, this is John Jeffrey speaking again. The purpose of this particular paper was to help us understand the issues that it's addressing. So I think it's probably not much more than that. We think it's an important element of understanding how to implement the policy that has been adopted insofar as there may be policy aspects relating to it. I don't think it's for ICANN staff to make a statement or a determination of whether it fits within the GNSO's policy purview or not. Certainly there are policy aspects relating to it, and there's certainly aspects of it relating to implementation of the policies that have been adopted.
Thanks, Sean. Cheryl, did you want to make your comment on before Danny?
If Danny's still on the call, I'm sure he'll be able to speak for himself. Danny, are you still on the call?
Doesn't sound like Danny is.
Yeah, we haven't heard Danny.
He was there in the beginning, although we did have a call starting.
Oh, he's dropped off, Cheryl.
Okay.
Yeah, so our log indicates he's no longer on the call.
That's fine. I will now act in proxy. He has forwarded a question which I believe, I haven't listened to the MP3 yet, but I believe he may have raised at the last call. So I'll do a short version of it. And that's to do with the board resolution dated 18th of October 2006, where there was an original call for to deliver findings on an economic question relating to the domain registration market, such as whether domain registration market is one market or whether each TLD functions as a separate market. And it goes on to a couple of other points. I believe his intention was for us to ask, is there an answer forthcoming to this previously stated question?
So I think we tried to answer that on the last call, and I don't have any new information about that. I'm looking at other staff to see if anyone else does. We can certainly take that question on and look at a more fulsome answer offline.
That would be great. I think if you take it on notice, but I gather his understanding was there would be a response the end of this week, and this is, of course, the end of this week. My reaction was you were probably waiting until after this call anyway, but if you can take it on notice, that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments that anyone in the room or on the call has? If not, I think that we'd like to thank you for participating in the call today, and we'll go ahead and call into this just a bit early. And we thank you for participating and for providing such valuable input into this process. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thanks.